Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to Hidden Growth Champions. In our studio today, I've got a very special guest, Sarah Elkins. Sarah dials in all the way from Montana in the northwest of the United States. I've truly enjoyed my conversations with Sarah, and I think she's got a really special story to tell about storytelling, why it's important, how does it fit within our busy professional lives, and some of the lessons that she's learned. So Sarah, welcome to our studio. It's absolutely fantastic that you've made time this morning to join us all the way from halfway around the globe and tell our audiences a bit about yourself.
Thank you so much. It's absolutely my pleasure. I really have enjoyed getting to know you as well, Sarah. Well, I guess the most important aspect of who I am and what I do is that I believe truly in connection with people. I am not one of the, I describe it as touchy-feely people that is particularly into emotion and sentiment. But I do find that storytelling is the key to building strong relationships and to clarifying who you are within a relationship and your own identity. So I am a Gallup certified StrengthsFinder coach, and I use that tool to guide my clients to uncover the stories that demonstrate their most natural, instinctive, fabulous talents. So I've been doing that for, I've been doing storytelling coaching for about 5 years, and I started using the Gallup tool about 3 or 4 years ago. And I've coached hundreds of people using this tool, and it's just so powerful to understand that telling somebody that you're smart or that you're an inspiration isn't going to work. If you have to tell people you're smart or you're authentic, you're probably not doing it right, but you can do it through storytelling. So that's me in a nutshell.
I am curious, is this something that you've always known? Is this something that you've come to recognize through your work? Was it a kind of a particular experience that brought that really home for you? Just how did you get to become, I mean, this is a fascinating profession and it's incredible work. How did you get to this?
I have not always known this. I'm one of those people that switch jobs really regularly. I would get bored after a while and either self-sabotage or just look for another position. I'd get into whatever I was doing and I would get passionate about it. I know so much about the library world from my time working in the libraries. I know a lot about the university system, faculty and the structure of universities and how those things work because of my time in higher education. And now I know a lot about public service in terms of government employment. And I just hit a point probably about 6 years ago, where I had been blogging a lot about customer service and customer experience. And that's where I thought my business was going to lead me, was to do a lot of training around that. And I would use stories as my demonstrations of what good customer service looks like and what poor customer service looks like. And I even had a book in my head that I never wrote, but I'm still working on, all about customer service and the fact that if you want to give and receive customer service that's excellent, you have to be a good customer. So it comes from both sides. So I was blogging about customer service and I wrote this blog post about a tour guide that I had experience with in Bavaria, in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. And he was just outstanding. And I wrote this article about lessons from a stellar tour guide. And almost immediately, a woman from the International Tour Management Institute gave me a call and asked me to submit a proposal to be one of their speakers at their annual symposium the following year. And I said, sure, yeah, I'd love to. And I said, on the topic of customer service, she said, no, storytelling. And I remember hesitating for just a moment, but I'm one of those Richard Branson fans that take something that you're not positive you are up to and find a way to do it and do it well. So I said yes and submitted the proposal, and I was selected to be their storyteller for that year. And it was amazing how receptive and responsive the audience was to storytelling. And I started really paying closer attention to it. And when I was working with somebody as her writing coach, this woman, this is about 4 years ago, just before I started my podcast, she was telling me that she has MS, but she doesn't talk about that in her writing and in her public speaking. And I asked her why. And she said, well, I don't want to be defined by my illness. And I said, well, that kind of surprises me, because all of the stories you've told regarding your illness to me have demonstrated your resilience, your sense of ambition and accomplishment. It has nothing to do with the illness itself. Those are the characteristics that I have derived from the stories you've told me. So I said, it's not the stories that are defining you. It's not your illness that's defining you. It's how you talk about it. And maybe 2 or 3 days later, as I was continuing to marinate or process this discussion in my head so that I could provide great service as a coach to her, I took a lot of time to think through that conversation. And that's when the title of my podcast and my book came into my head: Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. And as I started to interview people for my podcast, I heard more and more people, first of all, not knowing which stories to tell. They couldn't pinpoint a time in their life that was pivotal. They couldn't look back and pick out a story that would inspire an audience. I had to kind of maneuver within the conversation to ask exactly the right questions to draw these stories out. And I was surprised by that, which is part of why I started writing the book. And as I wrote the book, more and more, I saw how people's stories that they told not only impacted the perceptions of the people that were listening to them, but I could hear in their stories how these stories had affected their internal messages and their identity. And lucky for me, I happened upon some research. My husband actually sent me an article that started driving me toward the huge amount of research that's going on that actually comes to the same conclusion that I came to through hosting this podcast and through my work with clients, that indeed the stories you tell affect your identity. So that's how I got into it. And I have never been more passionate about something than this.
It's an incredible story. I do want to go back to the aspect of customer service, but much later in our conversation, and really spend a bit of time and talk about relationships. When you speak about identity, when you speak about how people perceive them through their stories, I was reminded that relationships are always dynamic. They're flowing. There is no, you know, one version that is eternal. They keep evolving. They keep challenging and changing shape as a result. What I wanted to ask you is, do you find that good storytellers change their story, or is it simply kind of adapted to the surface to fit the audience or to create the right environment for it to be heard? Do stories evolve as well by the people from which they originate?
Oh, absolutely. We always evolve our stories. As a matter of fact, I was working with a coaching client a few years ago. This was kind of early in this experimental phase of how I was coaching, using the StrengthsFinder as well as storytelling. And she was telling me a story about how when she was a little girl, her mother told her that she wasn't very bright. And I said, tell me about that. And she said, well, I remember I was about 10 years old. And my mother told me, you're not very bright, but you're very sweet, so you'll marry well. And I've been constantly trying to prove to myself and to her that she was wrong, that I am bright. And every time I do something that I'm proud of, my mom's been gone. She passed away years ago. I still continue to try to prove to her that I'm smart. And I said, wow, you were 10 years old. Your mom told you weren't very bright. She said, yeah. I said, tell me that story. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, let's get into the details here. Where were you sitting? And I had her describe the room to me, where she was sitting in the kitchen, at the table, what she could see from where she was sitting. I said, be in an observation mode. be a fly on the wall and tell me the story as if you're watching it happen, like it's a TV show or movie. And she told me the story and I kept asking for more detail. And I said, well, tell me the backstory. What was your mother going through at the time? Was she happy? And she said, oh no, she was so discouraged and disappointed because she was raising kids and her sister got to go to college. She knew she was smart enough to go to college, but she was kind of stuck and underestimated, and she knew that she could do more. And she was just, I guess, disappointed. And I said, wow, okay. So what else was going on with her? How was she dressed? And she said, oh, she probably had an apron on. She was probably cooking and getting ready for dinner. And I said, wow, that's really kind of sad, right? That she was relegated to this position of being mom and homekeeper when what she really knew she could accomplish was far greater. She said, yeah. And I said, do you think that maybe she was projecting her insecurities onto her 10-year-old daughter and also trying to protect you from maybe having expectations that you could do more? You could have seen the light go on behind her eyes as I described that to her. And then I asked her to retell the story with the full context at least twice in the next few days, and then call me and tell me what happened. So I encouraged her to retell the story differently, to make the adjustments based on what she knew her mother to be going through at that time as she looked back. And this woman was older, so this would have been in the 50s, in the late 50s, which, as we all know, women had different positions in the 50s. Unless they really were unique and stood up for themselves, they were relegated to certain roles in the household and at work if they worked. And by retelling the story, she called me a few days later and there was this lightness in her voice. And she said, telling the story from an observation point of view changed everything for me. So yes, we absolutely change our stories.
I wonder when I listen to this is how ingrained this ability to retell the story is in different parts of our lives. You know, I often observe people at work and how they take the origin story. It could be the entrepreneur story or the founder story or the last big success story or sometimes the last big failure story. You know, mm-hmm. The one we should do everything in our power to avoid making again. And two things come to mind for me. The first is how pervasive that becomes in the organization. How many people begin to believe the story as though there are no alternative avenues, there's no alternative path to the story. This becomes truth and the only way that the future can unfold. And the second thing that happens then is that any new talents, any new capabilities, any new avenues to do things differently kind of fall to the margin. They don't get told. They're not participating in the story. The story becomes about how things were then, a bit like your story about in the 1950s. So I kind of wonder, do we do the same thing at work? Do we become as, what's the right word? You know, is concrete and sometimes insensitive to how the story could be told differently in our working lives as we sometimes do in our personal lives to the story that you've mm-hmm. told earlier.
Well, sir, I don't actually separate personal and professional lives. I don't think it's possible. If you're mm-hmm. bringing your whole self to work, you're also bringing all your stories, your personal stories. And you are the expert when it comes to organizational storytelling. Company storytelling. I really focus on individual storytelling. And I can say absolutely without a doubt, many times our stories become so concrete that we stop looking for evidence that contradicts it. So it kind of drives me crazy when people, I read this all the time, stop telling yourself the story that you're not good enough, or stop telling yourself the story that you aren't smart or whatever. That's not a story. That's a label. That's an observation. I'm not good enough. That's not a story. The story is, as you said, the origin story. How did that message become so concrete in your mind? And what we find, and this is actually in the book, is that we are conditioned to, once we, it's a cognitive dissonance. Once we tell ourselves this story enough times, so this woman is not very bright because her mom told her that, from that point forward, no matter what else happens in her life, she's going to always look for the evidence that proves that story right. So when she goes to school, she gets straight A's, except that she gets a D in a math test. So now she's not very bright because she got a D in a math test, right? Like the rest of those A's, the ones that she worked so hard for, to get an A in statistics, to get an A in psychology, to get an A in English literature, whatever that is, it doesn't connect for that person because they failed or got a C or a D in math, and so they're not very bright. So we're constantly looking for evidence to prove that that comment that my mother made when I was 10 years old is accurate. And the only way to change that is to start really intentionally looking for the evidence that contradicts what she heard in that story. And as an example, for work related, I was working with a coaching client and she was getting ready for a trip and she was really stressed about going on this trip. And I said, why are you so stressed about this? You travel all the time. What are you so stressed about? She said, I get really stressed about travel. And I said, why? And she said, well, I'm afraid something's going to go wrong. And I said, okay, I hear you. Something almost always goes wrong. So tell me what you think is going to go wrong. She said, well, what if they lose my luggage? And I said, oh, okay. What if they lose your luggage? You're on your way to a conference. You're speaking the day after you arrive, right? You're arriving late in the evening and you're going to speak the next morning early. So what if they lose your luggage? Has that happened to you before? And she said, well, yeah. And I said, oh, okay. What happened? And she said, well, I was flying to Atlanta and they lost my luggage and I had to speak the next morning, just like this situation. I said, well, what did you do? And she said, well, I didn't get my luggage back in time, but I washed my underwear and I went immediately to a store and found a top, like in the gift shop at the hotel. I found a shirt that night and I was able to just go. And I had a toothbrush, you know, the hotel provided me a toothbrush and everything. And I said, wow, that sounds horrible. That must've been a horrible experience. And she said, well, no, it was fine. I worked it out. I made it happen. Right. And I said, oh, okay. So you were pretty resourceful at that moment. She said, well, yeah. And I said, well, that sounds like you have evidence to prove that if they lose your luggage, you're going to find a way to deal with it. And you could kind of see her shoulders start to drop a little. I said, what else is going to go wrong? What else do you think is going to go wrong? Well, what if I miss my flight? I said, oh gosh, isn't it horrible when you miss your flight? She said, oh yeah. I said, tell me about a time you missed a flight. And again, she told me the story. I said, wow, that sounds so terrible. Having to stay at the Denver airport for an extra 3 hours and eat a good meal and have a glass of wine. That must've been really horrible for you. And she laughed and she said, no, it wasn't so bad. I had some time to review my notes for my conference the next day. And I said, oh, okay. So you missed a flight because one of your flights was delayed. You had to wait 3 hours, but then you had that time to go over your notes and you did the presentation the next day. It was fine, right? She said, yeah. And I said, that sounds horrible, right? And she said, no. And she saw where this pattern was going. And she, again, it was one of those things where she had told a story because these terrible things had happened, but she wasn't looking at the resolution of her stories. She was only looking at the struggle.
Absolutely. Sarah, you've raised a very important point here, which is around patterns. And I often find patterns are very often the first signs or the first recognition that the story needs to change, where perhaps we've stumbled upon a new talent that we have got. We stumbled upon a new application, a new place, and a new way in which to apply ourselves. So I kind of wonder, when I think about these patterns, do you find that people go out deliberately to to find those? Do you find that they can recognize and become curious about changing patterns, whether it's about losing a luggage, and that's obviously accidental, right? Or whether it's something that starts repeating itself. Do you find that people who can tell good stories also become good at pattern recognition, who become good at, if not fully retelling the story, retelling parts of the story, or challenging their own story? And I mean, it was beautifully the way that we were describing it. She found that it was, it was actually quite fun, and she was quite resourceful. I guess the word I was looking for is they begin to improvise once they pick up on a pattern. They begin to practice something different. Is that something that comes up as they start to develop a new story?
I love that. That's the insight you pulled from this, Sara. That is huge. Patterns are a huge part of our lives. And I find that people who aren't aware of their stories, who aren't consciously aware of their stories, do not see patterns as easily as those of us who are aware of our stories. And I can tell you, this was actually in my book, it was a huge aha moment for me, where I was in a role I was a compliance officer for a federal grant, and I don't even like rules. So this was not a great fit for me. And added on top of that, I had a boss who was very rigid, very micromanager. Her strengths were definitely more in the deliberative consistency, responsibility, those executing talents. And mine are definitely more in the influencing, strategic thinking, and relationship building. And what I found was that when I was a compliance officer, the best way to make people compliant was to have them want to be compliant. So I connected with them. I picked up the phone. I learned about their children and their fur babies. I learned about where they lived. And my subgrantees were highly compliant. I rarely had a problem. But my boss was pretty abusive toward me. And she would say these really mean things. One time she even said, "I don't know why you were hired. You had none of the qualifications." I mean, just mean, cruel things. Mm-hmm. And I remember one moment, she said something awful to me. And I was already struggling with the beginnings of a migraine. And I walked into the bathroom and closed the door and turned off the light so that it was pitch dark in the bathroom, and just cried. And I am not a crier. It's not something I do a lot. I'm just not a particularly emotional person, but I had hit my limit, and I had this headache. And I finally turned the light back on, and I was rinsing my face with cold water, trying to clear away these tear-stained eyes and cheeks. And I looked in the mirror, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that this was not the first time I was there, that I had been in relationships like this before, and that this was my pattern. And I had to start to uncover the truth to where I was part of the problem, where some of it was my own interactions and my role. What was my role in this pattern? And I started to look back at the stories, and I'm talking very specific times in my life with certain people, certain relationships, and uncovering, okay, this happened with this woman, this happened with this man, this happened with this woman, and seeing that pattern of where maybe I had some role in the abuse. And let me go back a little bit. There is absolutely no excuse for that kind of bullying. And I am not responsible for the behavior of a bully in any way. However, once you see this pattern, you have to see that you have a role in it. And whether that means your lesson is to stand up for yourself, or your lesson is to see it before it happens and be able to extricate yourself from the situation, there is always some part of that situation that is yours to own. So yes, finding your stories. And when I work with certain coaching clients and they start to uncover these stories, absolutely, they start to see their own patterns and be able to choose with intention whether this is a damaging pattern or whether it's a pattern that they can live with, or whether it's a pattern that actually contributes to their personal growth. It's all about making sure you're conscious and intentional about it. So yes, great question.
I guess, and I'm always thinking back of your first comment around service. One of the things that I remember some time back we looked at is, why do teams in organizations go through the same pattern again and again? But to your last point, we're unconscious of it, even when all the evidence points to the contrary of being successful at it, to the contrary of actually achieving their objectives. And one of the things we found is that people tend to look at visions, when they look at aspirations, whether their own team created it or they adopted it from elsewhere. And it is almost as though we would convince ourselves that we could reach, and we are moving towards realizing this objective or this vision even more broadly, despite the best evidence. So the courage of actually standing and saying, I see a different pattern. Perhaps this vision is not fit for future anymore. Perhaps this is the best I knew about myself, or we knew about ourselves as a team at that point in time. Perhaps some things became clearer over the last few years, over the last few months, that would help us to question, that would help us to challenge. And maybe there are patterns that we simply didn't know about, but we can learn and we can adopt and we can reflect on. And I remember when we were looking in the context of specifically of customer service, we reached the conclusion that was pretty startling, that despite so many customer service teams and organizations that are trying to become so customer-centered and so helpful to their customers, it took, the data showed, and we looked at it across a number of industries, that it takes a minimum of 10 years, a decade, to be really good at customer centricity until you're ready to step out and apply it in a different market. Now, for most people who try to set ambitious goals, for most people who try to commit their organizations to, or even themselves, to charge into new territories, that almost sounds very demotivating, right? Decade, it's a very, very long period of time. But whenever we compare those who invested themselves, who became so customer-centered, who really applied themselves, like, I guess, to similar to that person you were describing in Germany when you got the invitation to speak about storytelling as a result of that experience and you sharing that experience, that wasn't a 3-month stint. That wasn't the person who just decided, what the hell, let me try this and see if I'm good at this. This is a person who developed mastery around this. And only then that were people willing to apply and use these new patterns. They became more successful at adopting them in different situations. They became more resilient. And I often find people don't have that appreciation for time. The time it takes, the time we give ourselves, whether it is to heal, to whether it is to listen and see those patterns, or whether it is to improvise and try things that are new, knowing that we're not good at them yet, but it's actually okay. I'm just kind of wondering what role does time and patience play in this process of becoming, you know, good storytellers of our own stories, being reflective enough to be able to change those stories when we need to?
You know, that's actually a much bigger question than maybe people would anticipate. So I'm going to use my StrengthsFinder experience as kind of the foundation for this. When we start something, we think we're pretty good at it. We have a tendency to just think we're good at it because of, I don't know, whatever basic comments we get from external sources. Internally, we might just see positive results from whatever we're doing. But if we look at ourselves a year later and we look back and we think, well, I was pretty good at it, but I'm so much better at it now. And then we go 2 years down the line and we look back at ourselves from 2 years before when we first started, where we thought we were pretty good at something. And we think, oh my gosh, I'm so much better at that now. I thought I was really good then. But we have to be humble. We have to understand that we were good at it, maybe to a certain extent, but we still had a lot to learn. And when we can look back at the times that we didn't do so well, or that we thought we did well, but now we look back and we think, okay, for my experience, I did that well, but I would do it a lot better now because I have, you know, 2 years under my belt at doing this. I think it's really a matter of being humble and knowing that we weren't all that 2 years ago. And part of why that's so important is because of how we influence others. So when we are telling a story about ourselves from 2 or 5 or 10 years ago, and we don't talk about the struggle from then and how we can look back now and understand that, yes, you know, we were okay at it, but given certain time and lessons and understanding, we would do it differently now. If we can tell that story, then we are giving grace to the people who are just starting and just learning. And that's how we inspire people to continue their own growth. And as a leader, that's what we want, right? Is to inspire people, to have people want to embrace our vision, for people to want to know that our character is in alignment with our behavior. And that's how we do it, is by telling the stories of what we did wrong as somebody less experienced. And then internally, when we can look back at those patterns and see where, wow, you know, when I did that keynote 5 years ago, I did it well, I got good reviews, but man, now that I've learned so much in the last 5 years of doing more of these presentations, I would do it differently now, even though I was successful then. I got good evaluations. They would rehire me, you know, whatever. You have the external gratification, the external acknowledgement that you did a good job. But internally, you know, you could have done better now, 5 years later, 10 years later. And what that does is it puts us in a position where now, when we start something new, we have a little bit more of a humble beginning, knowing that we are learning, and that in 5 years, we will likely look back and say, I would do that differently now, but I did a good job given the circumstances. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. And I guess tied to it, I guess my next question would be, what advice would you give to people who feel they don't have a good story to tell yet, who fear, their story might not land well, might not be appreciated, might not be understood by others? I guess you're sharing a very human side of storytelling, which is we are always getting better. We are always becoming. But what advice would you give to those? Say, maybe I'm not ready to tell the story. Mm-hmm. Maybe I never will. Do I have a good story to share?
Well, there are a couple of pieces here. One would be start to create a story portfolio. That's what I call it. It's a collection of your stories. I categorize them. In my book, I categorize them by era in your life. But as I've worked with some startups and coaching clients that are teams from organizations that want to start collecting stories for their organizational story portfolio, I can suggest that you start with topics, categories such as client experiences, very specific client experiences, travel, something you experienced when you were away from your home, something related maybe to a learning experience at home, a personal learning experience. And each one of those categories, you can say any story within this category maybe will be demonstrating my character as a compassionate human being. Maybe a story in this category will demonstrate my natural talent in strategic thinking. So that, again, you don't have to say I'm a strategic thinker. You tell a story within that category. So I would encourage anyone to start building a story portfolio. And that can start with your young adulthood. It can start with this week. So one of my examples would be, I had a really beautiful Mother's Day here in the United States last Sunday, and I'm not a sentimental person. I'm not a Mother's Day celebrator. I don't like the Hallmark holidays. I find them to be very contrived. But now that both of my boys are out of the house and we are what they call empty nesters, I actually woke up on Sunday morning to the sound of our boys talking in the kitchen and laughing. And they are almost 20 and 22. And I heard them laughing, talking to each other. I couldn't hear the words, just the mumbling. And then I could hear their awful music. And I remember laying in bed for a moment, just listening and having that kind of nostalgia come over me. And then I realized, oh my gosh, my boys are in the house and I'm not with them. So of course I jumped out of bed and got dressed and went downstairs so I could spend a little time with them. That's a story. And I would add that to my story portfolio so they can be, I would encourage you to remember that your stories don't have to be epic. They just have to be meaningful. And when I tell that story about Mother's Day, whether you have children or not, you have the sense of who I am and what's important to me. Nice. So that's my advice. Start your story portfolio. Think in terms of how you demonstrate certain aspects of your character and your vision by telling a specific moment in time so that people don't have to guess and so that you have some influence over how you're being perceived, especially if your intent is to inspire confidence, to inspire motivation and ambition toward a vision. If you want to inspire stronger connection, because you can't do it by yourself. Regardless of your CEO status or your executive level status, your people, your team are the ones that are going to make you look good and be successful. So paying attention to the stories you share that inspire them and then actively listening to their stories, that's how you get serious connection and inspiration.
It's a great point to end on. Sarah, this has been a wonderful conversation. There's so many insights, and I'm so glad that that you kept it at a very personal, at a very individual level. We often forget that, right? We get roped into the title and the role and the expectations of the story that we forget that it's actually all about the human relationship. So I just want to say thank you for everything you shared with our audiences. And thank you for spending time with us in our virtual studio.
Thank you, Sarah. It was absolutely my pleasure.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.